This is Karen Brewster, and today is May 5th, 2024, and I'm here with Dick Mackey at his home in Palmer, Alaska, and we're talking about the history of the Iditarod Trail. Now, you've written a very good book that covers the story of your life and career and your experiences with the Iditarod race and the Coldfoot Camp and all that. So I'm not going to repeat all that of your life story here and just sort of jump right into the Iditarod Trail itself, if that's okay with you.
It's good.
Okay. So I was thinking the place to start would be the 1967 Centennial Race and Dorothy Page.
Well, my introduction to the Iditarod Trail was through Joe Reddington Sr.
Okay.
In 1966, in the fall of 1966, in preparation for the Centennial Race in 1967. And at that time, I was a comparatively new sprint musher in Anchorage, and Joe would come into Anchorage on occasion to run the races down there, and he asked me if I would be interested or willing to help work on this Iditarod Trail for an upcoming race in 1967. And at that time, I did a lot of work on the Anchorage for Rendezvous Trail and all the local race trails. And that's why he approached me. And I said, sure. Now, going from Anchorage to Connect was a large undertaking back in those days. And but anyway, I agreed. And on a Saturday afternoon, Joey Reddington, his son, and I went out to a place called 9 Mile Hill out of Connect. And you know, when you travel across the United States and you get to a certain point and they point out, there's the tracks from the Oregon Trail. Well, you know, I just fell in love with that kind of stuff.
Right.
And so here is the trail in a wet area, not a water-holding swamp, but a wet area. And over a period of time, the sleds had made a definite indentation through the country there, and here's this trail that people went with sleds and on foot all the way to Iditarod, and I mean, I just ate that kind of stuff up.
Yeah.
And so I was hooked. I participated in that race the next year, unfortunately, I was working on it until just a couple hours before the race, and that seemed to be the way things went for me. I was always working on the trail rather than perhaps training my dogs the way I should, and so I didn't do very well, but that's okay. Following that race, 10 of us got together, and we each put $100 in the kitty. And $100 in those days was a lot of money.
Yeah.
And we formed the Iditarod Trailblazers, of which I was a lifetime member with Joe's signature on the card. I still have that card in a frame on the bookcase over there. And then there was a group called the Iditarod Trail Committee, of which I was not a part of. And then we were going to, the idea was to have a long-distance race, and it just kind of simmered along. Well, in 1969, they ran that same race again that we had run in 67, but I had to work, and so I didn't go in that one. And then in November of 1972, Joe Reddington called me up at his normal hour of midnight and said, I just went to a meeting in Anchorage and met a guy that seemed to say that he could raise some money for this long distance race that we've talked about. But when I told him we were going to Iditarod, he said, well, where's that? And he says, why don't you go to Nome? Everybody knows where Nome is. He said, what do you think? And I said, well, I'll be the second one to sign up. And he kind of hesitated. He says, what do you mean? Well, aren't you signed up already? And then he informed me that the next day we had to be to this place in Anchorage to meet with some of these people. And we did. And that was the start of my involvement in the organization part of it. It took a great many people to put that race on when it happened in 1973. But there was a few of us that, I guess, devoted our lives to it.
Right.
Joe was one heck of a general, and we were his, if he was the general, we were the colonels.
Right.
And everything was donated back in those days. It's a completely different race than it is today. But that's another story.
Right.
You still have to take a dog team from one end to the other.
Right.
So therefore it's also the same.
Right.
Okay.
And it still follows the same route.
It still follows the same route. Now, I was under the impression that that route was surveyed years and years ago, and that those records burned up in the courthouse fire in Juneau years ago. Now, I don't know that as fact, but that's what I've been told.
Okay.
But I do know this, that the state of Alaska didn't know the entirety of where that race went specifically. In 1981, the spring of 81, the Alaska Department of Natural Resources awarded Joe Reddington and I a contract to find and mark the original, and that was the key word, the original Iditarod Trail from Knik to Rainy Pass Lodge. Excuse me. And we took that contract thinking, yeah, that'll be a nice couple of weeks. It took us 6 weeks. And it was an amazing adventure.
And is that where you were in an airplane? And he was on the ground?
I was in an airplane 99% of the time while Joe was on the ground. From the air, you could follow it. Okay? On the ground, you could be standing. And now, here's another thing. It always went on a compass bearing. They never just wandered around. And whoever put the trail in, the old timers that put it in, never went in the open unless they had to. They always were in the tree line if they possibly could be.
Why would that be, do you know?
Well, because if you were out in the open, the wind would blow in and obscure the trail.
Okay.
So anyway, we, and the state had open to entry land, they had homesteads, they had all kinds of stuff. And I filed and started on a homestead. I sold out eventually at Montana Creek prior to the Parks Highway. And I know this, that your homestead was subject to trails, easements, and whatever. Okay? Now, I'm going to go back to Nine Mile Hill.
Right.
That was a homestead. And the gentleman that proofed up on that homestead ultimately passed away and willed it to his two daughters, who were adamant that that trail not go by their house on their property, and they rerouted it a different way. And Department of Natural Resources, the people from it, had come to my home in in Willow on numerous occasions talking about this, and it finally got to the point, four or five years ago anyway, maybe even longer, hard to think about it. But I had to go when they had the attorneys and do a deposition at the Department of Natural Resources on my telling where this trail went. And I believe it to be accurate. Okay. In the meantime, they, my understanding, had made a route around it and continued on. My idea was that you could shut down the park's highway. I can still drive to Fairbanks. That's not the point. The trail goes at a specific place. And ultimately, it ended up being that way.
Because I was going to ask you, why would it matter if they rerouted it a little bit?
Because that wasn't the trail. And our deal was, where is the original trail? Okay? And I think we followed it. Now, when we got to Susitna Station, now we have a problem. Because there's all kinds of open-to-entry parcels of land given out. People had put up cabins, or maybe they hadn't done anything yet. Well, guess what? That is the trail. You might not like it that it goes within 20 feet of your cabin, but that is the trail.
So the trail took precedent.
What?
The trail took precedence over private land ownership.
Well, as far as we were concerned in locating and marking the trail. And then Baumhoff and Associates, of which Bert Baumhoff is also an Iditarod finisher, his company was to actually survey the trail behind us. And I suppose following our deal, it did. But, and I'll give an example. Somebody way past, years ago, decided to go to Alexander Lake and build what they may have called a lodge, okay? I don't know how that progressed. But you're going along the Iditarod Trail, and a little ways over here on the lake is a lodge. Well, of course, that's where the trail went to.
Right.
But that wasn't what our directive was. See, we had to find the original Iditarod Trail. Okay. Today, when you leave Willow, starting in the Iditarod race, you do not actually hit the Iditarod Trail until 13 miles past Quintana.
Oh.
Yeah.
Well.
At a place back then on the map called Quintana Crossing.
Well, that would make sense because it came from Seward and went through Crow Pass. And then over it, it wouldn't have gone all the way up to Willow.
No, no.
It would have come across.
It went what's now known as Eagle River.
Right.
Okay. When you get to Eklutna and go across the flats, you can follow it very easily.
Okay.
Yeah, on the ground. And the vegetation never grew back on it.
That's what's amazing. That's what I was
it is.
Like, how did you guys, like the 9 Mile Hill, which was right at the beginning,
yeah.
How did you know where to...
Because there was a wooden block and tackle high up in a birch tree that didn't used to be high up in a birch tree. It used to be in a tree to help lower the heavily loaded sleds down 9 Mile Hill.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. And that's one of the first things Joe pointed out to me. Look at that block and tackle up there. Wow.
So they were to hook the sled to it to slow it down?
Yeah, yeah.
So the block and tackle was at the top of the hill?
Yes, yes, yeah. In a high tree now. Well,
right.
Now I say now, I haven't been there in a long time.
Well, that was 1966,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah. It was there in 1981, mm-hmm. Yeah. And a guy lived in Iditarod, and when we started going through Iditarod, Jim Hastings, I used to land there, and we became pretty good friends. And he gave me a map of all the roadhouses in Alaska in 1924. And Jules Meade, that used to own Thielen's store, Jules and Leslie Meade, he became an executive director of Iditarod in future years, bought that map for $500 to the Iditarod. He has that map, well, he's passed away, but his widow, Leslie, has that map in his house today. And it showed all the roadhouses on the Iditarod Trail. Uh-huh. It's an amazing
yeah.
piece to see.
And now, were any of those roadhouses still visible when you were marking the trail or using the trail?
Yes. You could see you had the one at Connect, of course. And then the next roadhouse where you could see remnants of it was at Squintner Crossing at Pontilla Lake. And then the next roadhouse I found by chance in running the first race. We left McGrath and went to Ofa. At that time, we ran through the old radar site out of McGrath and came up on top of this hill, and I looked down in the valley and I saw smoke. I was running by myself. And I saw where the trail took off to the left. And I went down there, and there's a guy waving his arms, "You missed the trail, you missed the trail." I said, "No, I didn't. I'm cold and I want to go and get a cup of coffee." He says, "Well, we don't have a cafe here, but come to my house." And he says, "Why are you coming through the old radar site? There's the original trail over the hill, and what's my bar is what's left of the old roadhouse here in Takotna."
Okay.
I said, "Next year we'll be here." And of course that became one of the favorite resting places along the trail. And then the next roadhouse that I remember was at Poraman. And that roadhouse, the main lodge, the roof had caved in, but the lodge was, the walls were pretty much standing. But on the back of the lodge was the old dog, where they kept the dog teams.
Oh, yeah.
And they had the still, what would you call them, little stalls.
Yeah. It's like a dog barn.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And of course, that was just something to see, I thought.
Yeah, well, I've heard about those old dog barns.
Yeah.
People and would spend the night and put their dogs up.
Up on the brow of the hill was a steam engine, like a railroad steam engine. And we got to Poraman, and what was his name? Norman. I can't remember his last name. Anyway.
So he was living out there.
And he was a gold miner. He and his wife lived in there. They lived in Anchorage and then had some really nice old homes there.
So where is Poraman? That's not a current Iditarod stop that I've heard of.
Well, how am I going to say this? We went from Ophir to Cripple to Gaines Creek to Poraman. We didn't go to Cripple back in those days.
So it's between Ophir and Ruby?
It's on the way to Ruby.
It's on the way to Ruby, okay.
Okay.
That helps.
Long ways to Ruby.
But it's somewhere between Ophir and Ruby.
Yes.
Okay.
And I said to Norm, I said, "How did those engines get up there? That steam engine get up there?" He said, "They shipped it." I don't know. He said, "I don't know where it came from in the States, but it came from Seattle to St. Michael."
And they barged it up?
And they barged it up to Ruby, and then oxen.
Wow.
Drug it overland. And he said, then the people that brought it lived off the oxen.
Well, that's like I've been on the Chilkoot Trail.
Uh-huh.
And similar, there are these big, huge boiler kind of things that helped run a tramway.
Yeah.
And it's like, how the heck did they get those huge boilers up there?
Same thing.
Yeah, same thing. I didn't realize.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, but I've always just taken to stuff like that.
Yeah.
Kathy and I hiked the Chilkoot Trail. Same thing.
Right.
Oh, man. Well, just...
well, that's what I was... I've hiked the Chilkoot, and you see all these pieces of history.
Yeah.
And I wondered whether that was... Yeah. Any of that was still there in those early... Yeah. Those first year of the race.
Yeah. Yeah.
What kind of stuff you might have seen along the trail.
You know, more people walked the Iditarod Trail. Now, but here's another thing. If you lived in Fairbanks... and you took the Dunbar Trail, and you took this trail and that trail, and you went to Iditarod. What trail did you go on? You went the Iditarod Trail. If you lived in Nome, and you went to Iditarod, you went on the Iditarod Trail. So, how do you define the Iditarod Trail?
Well, that's what I was wondering, is how you and Joe marking out that section from Kinnick to Rainy Pass... How did you know where to go?
Well, we knew from looking at old map and talking to some old timers that knew where the old roadhouses were. And then I'll give you a good example. Joe and I, one of these stops, we were standing there just talking. What are we going to do now? You know, type of thing. And I glanced down, and not 3 feet away, well, that looks like an old window frame or something. And we got poking around in the brush, and that's the what was the top of a window was now maybe just 2-3 inches off the ground. The whole thing had sunk, and we got looking around. We were standing right beside a cabin that... I mean, why would you go 10 feet off the trail, you know?
Right.
So they built those cabins right by the trail. Yeah.
Huh, interesting. Yeah.
It was very interesting.
What time of year did you and Joe do that?
Late spring. Or early spring, however you want to define it. The snow had gone.
Okay, that was my question.
But the ground was still so you could travel.
So how did Joe travel on the ground?
With dogs.
He could still go with dogs?
He lived in a tent.
Okay.
He lived in a tent, and then he always camped. We didn't make that many miles a day, and he always camped where I could land.
Okay.
Yeah.
Because I was wondering, so he could use his dogs on the bare ground?
Oh, yeah, yeah. And not just enough to haul the supplies.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah.
I didn't realize that a dog sled would...
We'd sit there in the evening, you know, and just talk dogs. Talk family.
Yeah.
Yep.
And so was Joe brushing out the trail, or how was he marking it?
No. We marked it. We marked it by blazes, and...
We need to tell people who don't know what a blaze is.
Or we just take an axe on the side of a tree, mark it.
And cut out a little
cut
bit
out,
of the
cut
tree.
Cut out a chunk, yeah.
Yeah.
And that's another thing. You'd see a tree maybe 1.5 feet in diameter, and lo and behold, it had a blaze on it, but it would all grow in, you know, and sure enough, that's a blaze. You had to really look and recognize it as a blaze. Uh-huh. Yeah.
So were blazes always on the same side of a tree, or did they do, you know, on the trail a blaze on the right side, the next one's on the left side? And...
Whoever did the blaze was right-handed.
So they were always on the right side of the trail,
and it depended. You know, you don't know what the timber was like back in those days.
Right.
You know, there were a lot of places where there was no timber.
Oh, we have a picture.
Yeah, there's a picture of Joe and I at the Knick Museum on the trail.
1981, marking the trail with an official Iditarod Trail sign.
Yep, and that is on the trail.
Okay.
Unfortunately, it went right through what came out to be a cemetery.
Oh.
An old cemetery, yeah.
So the trail went through an old cemetery?
No. The cemetery developed where the trail used to be.
Oh, yeah. So what did you guys do?
We went around that.
That one you did go around.
Yeah, but we didn't go more than 50 feet.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, so you blazed and marked it, but you didn't brush out the trail.
No, we didn't brush out the trail, no. Well, I don't guess we needed to.
I mean, how did Joe get through with his dog team? He must have brushed out some of it.
Oh.
Or was it visible?
Oh, wait a minute. I'm getting ahead of myself. The trail was used all the way to Sioux Sittna Station. And that had been all brushed out prior to the first 67 race, okay?
Where did the 67 race go?
I can't remember how many miles on the Iditarod Trail it went, actually. And then it veered off to the right and ended in Big Lake. It was 28 miles in length.
So it was from Connecticut.
And whoever heard of a 28-mile race?
Yeah, I thought it was 25, but 28 miles.
28 miles.
So it was from Connecticut to Big Lake?
Connecticut to Big Lake. Okay. That's correct.
And so that part of the trail was brushed out.
And I can't remember just how far it was before we turned off. I know it was over 9 Mile Hill. Yeah.
Right, because you and Joey did 9 Mile
That's
Hill.
That's correct.
And you brushed it out?
Yeah.
And how did you do that? Hand or chainsaws or what?
Well, whatever was needed. Yeah. We had chainsaw with us. Yeah. And we had brush cutters and axe. Yeah. We actually cleared it out. It was visible, but we cleared it out so it was good for racing.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Now we get to Sioux Sittna Station. And we went from Sioux Sittna Station on a seismograph trail, in part, to Squintna. Following this deal with Joe and I, we went on the Iditarod Trail across Fish Lake and veered off when we got to Squintna as an accommodation and deal to Joe Delia at Squintna. And we did that 2 years in a row. But that trail was not used by the snow machine community. And the mushers really had a fit because we went all the way on the Iditarod Trail, veered off to Squintna, then came back and continued on the Iditarod Trail. That's the time when they started going and restarting in Willow.
Okay.
Up until that time, it was my job to where are we going to start. We ran from Anchorage the first two races, and then I had a problem getting permit from Eklutna the third year, mm-hmm. and the highway department absolutely said you may not disrupt traffic on the Matanuska bridges.
Mm-hmm.
So that's when we started going to Eagle River and then trucking them.
Right.
Well, the race had got such a following by then, the third year, that there's no way the ice is going to hold it, connect. And so we ran from Settlers Bay, where the lodge is now, before it was built.
Mm-hmm.
And then we ran wherever we could find snow. One year we ran from Nancy Lake.
Well, and then you ran from Fairbanks one year.
Well, those 2 years, yeah, that was way past my time. Yeah,
that more recently.
1978, the year I won,
right.
We left from Big Lake.
Oh.
Yeah. As long as Joe was alive, we pretty much had to go to Kinnick.
Right.
Yeah, he insisted upon that. We started several years where the old Wasilla Airport was, which is now a park behind the mall.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. And crossed the highway and followed the Kinnick in the Kinnick Road to Kinnick. Yeah.
Right.
So, yeah.
But as you say, those were like feeder trails into the main Iditarod trail.
Yeah.
So tell me about Joe Delia at Squintna. Why did you make an accommodation for him?
Well, Joe Delia was as part of the Iditarod, never had a dog team. But he's the one that, and I can't think of his partner's name either. I'm terrible at names anymore. I used to think I could remember them all, but he made sure the trail was in to the Rhone checkpoint every year.
Okay.
From Susitna Station all the way up to Rainy Pass. No, to Rainy Pass Lodge. We didn't go through Rainy Pass itself and the Dalzell Gorge until 1977.
Okay.
That was the first year. Yeah. And it was also, that was the first year we went to Nikolai as well.
Okay.
Yeah.
So why did the route change if you were looking for the original trail?
Well, we stayed on the original until we went to Willow. That changed the whole thing. Now we run the river all the way to Squintna. And those 2 years was when we went from Susitna Station and stayed on the trail, other than deviating off to Squintna and then back to the trail again. And then once we left Rhone checkpoint, it was convenient to go to the FAA station at Farewell.
Okay.
Then from Farewell, we went over to Salmon River to Cabin, and those people from Nikolai came over there for their spring beaver trapping.
Okay.
And that became an unofficial checkpoint.
Right.
And then to Big River, and then into McGrath. Following the fire in the Farewell Burn,
right,
we went, then we went on the Iditarod Trail.
Oh.
Left Rhone and did not go to Farewell. Went over to Stan Frost, had a cabin on Farewell Lake, and this old Sullivan Roadhouse, and then on to Nikolai, and then into McGrath. Yeah, so that was the only major change, was from Rhone.
Because of the fire.
Because of the fire. The fire brought us to the Iditarod Trail. Yeah, and bypassed the Farewell FAA.
Okay.
Which ultimately was closed anyway, yeah.
So, according to this, Joe Delia's wife was Norma.
No, that's right, yes.
Okay.
Yep.
And they lived out there and ran a trap line and knew the trails?
Yeah, and Frank. I can't think of his name. Joe Delia and Frank.
Yeah, Frank. Huh. No, Carl Fritzler.
Carl Fritzler.
Frank Harvey.
Huh?
Frank Harvey.
Yes, Frank Harvey. Yeah. Yeah.
And they lived out there and...
He lived at a place called Donkey Lake, past Squintna.
Frank Harvey did.
Yep. Yep.
And then...
And they both passed away.
Oh, yeah. The Delias lived at Squintna.
Yeah.
Yeah. So they were responsible for their section of trail?
Yeah. They put the trail in from Susitna Station through Squintna, across Ptarmigan Pass, down the river to Rome. And then in 1976, they came backwards from Rome through Rainy Path to Pontilla Lake. That's the first time they'd been through there. See, that's the way Rainy Pass and Dalzell Gorge, back in the old days, they never went through the gorge like we did today. It was built up on the side of the mountain, and prior to the 1964 earthquake, you could see parts of it, but the 64 earthquake shook those old logs down.
Okay.
And it just absolutely destroyed it, and it was easier, perhaps, to put the trail in through the gorge now.
Yeah, in those places that, the trail was, the original Iditarod Trail got damaged by the earthquake, so you had to put in a new trail.
That's correct.
And how do you decide where?
Well, there was only one place to go. If you were not going to build it up, mm-hmm. and log it up and put it in, the only place you could go was at the bottom of the ravine,
okay.
It's not a river maybe, but you'd think it was.
Yeah. So the terrain kind of told you where.
Terrain determined where you were going to go, and over the years, there was only two or three of us in 1977 that made it to Rome without broken sleds.
Yeah.
And it's been improved over the years.
Well, I don't
greatly.
I don't know how anybody gets through that section without breaking a sled or a body part something.
Well, you never train your dogs to go slow, you know.
I know. It's a crazy thing. But so on that 9 Mile Hill section, that was sort of the first...
9 Mile Hill got a reputation. It wasn't more than 150 feet long, but it was just
steep. Right.
Yeah. And for a heavily laden freight sled, it would have been a challenge.
Right.
And that's why that block and tackle was there.
But that was the first time that people went out and marked the trail or brushed it out?
My directive in 1973 was to make sure the trail was in to Susitna Station and marked, okay?
Okay.
None of us had any comprehension of what a dog team would do after a couple of days.
Uh-huh.
There was one place where a group of us, there was Ron Aldridge and Dave Olson and half a dozen of us. We actually built a bridge across the gully. It probably was 30 feet long because we didn't realize we could feed a team down over that and back up again.
Hmm.
Yeah. And Bob Bacon, who was a old-time resident of Flathorn Lake, after the first race, got a hold of me and he said, "Why on earth did you run that old seismograph trail? Why don't you follow my trap line? That's the original trail. I'll pull my traps next year."
Wow.
See? And so the second year of running, we did, in fact, run that mile long or whatever of the old original trail. See?
Yeah. Yeah. So with that seismograph trail, that's not... I read that Joe Reddington got some Army guys...
Got what?
There was an Army... let me see.
Well, the first year...
71, 72... Oh, that's your telephone.
Kathy's... Let's go back.
So in 1971 or 72, Joe Reddington met with the Army and somehow arranged that they would use snow machines as a training exercise.
All right. Prior to that, Fort Rich, I forget who now, got a hold of me, and they had a ski deal up at Arctic Valley out of Anchorage.
Right.
Okay. And said, what would you say is an average dog team? And I said, oh, depends what you're racing. But I said, 7-dog team take you any way you want to go. He said, all right. Would you be willing to take a 7-dog team from Arctic Valley back to the provost office there at Fort Rich, and we're going to test 2 Alpine snow machines and see how they do? Well, I beat them because they floundered.
Okay. Was there a trail?
Huh?
Was
no. There, no, we just took off cross country.
You were breaking trail.
Now, the idea was they were going to test Alpine snow machines for the Army and go to Nome. So Joe Reddington met with General Getty, who was a great promoter of dog racing. We used to race on base all the time. And convinced him that on their way to Nome, they would use survey tape and mark the trail as they went. And they were attempting to follow old-time maps of the Iditarod Trail. Okay? Of course, the wind would blow them off, and we spent more time looking for the trail after it blew in. You'd come onto a swamp, and you'd think the trail was straight ahead. No, it'd make a 9-degree turn or something, and no marking. So anyway, Happy River, there was no such thing the first couple of years as the steps. You just crashed into each other. And we went up the Happy River, actually up the river.
Wow.
On shelf ice, with this rushing river down 6 feet below you, and here you are on a ledge of ice waiting to give way. And they went up there with snow machines, and we made it with dog teams. But, and then the guy that used to fly out of Talkeetna up to McKinley all the time, Sheldon. Don Sheldon. All of a sudden, he's up there looking down off this cliff, and he says, what are you guys all doing down there? He said, the old trail's up here. Yeah, so the next year, we went up there.
And he could see it because he'd seen it from the air.
You could see it from the air, that's right. So, those snow machiners, they went through 33 snow machines and one made it to Nome.
Wow.
And you mentioned Carl Fritzler earlier.
Right.
He was one of 5 or 6 guys that went ahead on our behalf.
Oh.
To try to go to Nome.
So he tried to do it by dog team before the race?
No, they went on snow machines.
Oh, Carl Fitzler went on snow machines.
Yeah, they went on snow machines, and they cannibalized all the different snow machines, and he's the only one that made it there.
So the Army just left machines along the way?
Well, they must have got them out somehow. Not my deal. I got no idea.
Well, no, because you said Carl cannibalized. So did he cannibalize ones that had been left
Yeah,
along
just to
the
keep
way?
Another one going, yeah. I would assume they did them at villages, you know.
Yeah. But, so do you know how Joe knew the Army was going to do that?
Yes, they agreed to do that.
No, but Joe somehow knew that they were going to Nome with snow machines. And
yes, he did.
And had the idea to take advantage of that.
Like you say, General Getty was very real promoter of, well, and the Army had its own dog team.
Oh, they did?
Joey Reddington won the Anchorage Fur Rendezvous in 1965, driving the Army dog team.
Huh.
Yeah. And then the Air Force got one also, and I can't think of his name. They were kind of an afterthought, I think.
Oh, I didn't realize that they had their own teams.
Yeah, and actually Earl Norris kind of put a stop to that. He said, why is federal tax dollars competing against us? Yeah. He didn't like that.
He wanted to win. He didn't want them to win. Right? Yeah, because that seemed like a pretty good deal to have the snow machines breaking the trail.
Yeah, kind of.
It didn't work out so well.
No, it didn't. No. I lived over on Pittman Road at the time, north of Wasilla. I'd go over to Joe's, and I went over there on a Saturday morning. We had planned on going out the trail, and all of a sudden, here's a whole bunch of Army trucks, and these guys were unloading those Alpines, and they all lined up, and Captain Lockhart was in charge of it. And next thing you know, here come a helicopter, and General Getty gets out, and they all line up and salute and have a fit, and then they took off. So we waited until after lunch, and, well, we'll go for a run then. We didn't go 10 miles, and they had bivouacked for the night. Yeah, it got to be a joke watching helicopters fly snow machines back and forth.
That's how they pulled out the old machines, was with helicopters.
It was pretty good. So, but we certainly welcomed the part where it did work.
And so how long did it take them, though? How long did it take the one machine to get the Nome?
The day before the mushers got there.
Oh. Yeah. So they were that?
Well, it took them a month.
A month.
Yeah. It took us 3 weeks. 20 days.
For the first one was 20
of course,
days.
Those of us that did this back in those days, you know, think the ones that do it now.
But, right.
Yeah.
It's a different, totally different thing.
Yeah.
Right.
And half of them I know could not last 3 weeks out there.
Yeah. Well, and also 1973, when you first ran it, the trail was not as well known and marked as it is now.
It was awful.
It was awful. How was it awful?
It truly was. It was soft. It was blown in. No, and if it blew in, too bad, put on snowshoes. And that's just the way it was. And here's another thing. We cooked dog food. You never ran at night. You come 5, 6 o'clock or whatever. Usually about 5 o'clock, you found a decent place. Well, if you found a decent place to camp, here's 6 or 8 other teams along there. And so you all were looking for wood, and you had big galvanized tub and cooked for you. You had to melt snow, cooked for your dogs, all right? Well, the next year you stopped at the same place. Well, you got to go a little bit further for some firewood. Mm-hmm. And after a little bit, well, now there is no wood. So you pick a different place. And so that's what forced you to change how you did things. You know, the first year, Ralston Purina donated 20 tons of Purina High Pro dog food, which was the best you could get. Mm-hmm. Spader's Feed and Seed in Anchorage was $300 a ton.
Wow.
Yeah, came in a 50-pound sack, too. Okay. Today, they got some good dog food.
Right.
And it cost you $70, $80 for a 40-pound bag.
Right.
Yeah. But, and by the third year, we were using Coleman stoves. Well, next thing you know, you've got, instead of a big burner and a little burner, you got 2 big burners. Well, now you've got 2 tanks of oil, fuel, feeding them. And it just kept developing.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
We had real tarps. I mean, heavy tarps.
Right, those canvas tarps.
I had the first sled bag there was. Lolly Medley made it for me. Had a fit. Why do you need that? You know? Yeah.
Right, because the traditional way is you just throw a tarp over everything.
Yeah.
So. Well, and so Dorothy Page's idea of that 1967 race was for history. She was interested in the history, right?
Yes.
And so how did that connection get made with the race and the history?
Well, Dorothy Page is the one that suggested to Joe Reddington that they have that centennial race on the Iditarod Trail.
Uh-huh.
Okay. The rest of it from there on, just everybody followed suit. Like I say, there was, it took a lot of people to put it on.
Right.
A lot of people, hundreds of people. But there was a half a dozen of us in the Wasilla Anchorage area that we kind of devoted our lives to.
Yeah.
Now, the other end was more the organization for a headquarter type thing on the other end of the race.
Mm-hmm.
It didn't have that much to do with the trail.
Right.
Okay.
I mean, the Nome Trailblazers did go out and mark the trail for the race, didn't they?
No. The guys, as an example, now you didn't have to mark the trail on the Yukon River.
Okay.
It was utilized, okay, between villages. Now, from Caltag to Unicleet, with the old woman point in between, the old woman point was a point where the Iditarod Trail and the trail from Anvik on the Yukon River came up there and met.
Mm-hmm.
All right? Now, the guys from Caltag would go to Old Woman. I'm not going any further. I'm not going over into that Eskimo country. The guys from Unicleet would go to Old Woman. I'm not going over there to Caltag in that Indian country. The second year of the race, I was the first one to Caltag. I left Caltag and this isn't where we went last year. I ended up way up on the side of a hill and it's dark. And I think, oh, I've missed the trail somewhere. And all of a sudden, here come an airplane I see in the distance. You could tell he was flying the trail and he came right up over me. So I knew I was on the trail. What happened? Clarence Twarick from Unicleet decided they'd go all the way to Caltag and put the trail in. But they wouldn't go into the village. They went to the airstrip and turned around. Well, they knew about where they were and they went up on this side hill to see where they were.
Oh.
And then they followed the same trail back again. And so the first year, we get to Unicleet. George Atlas says, oh, I like this country. He says, there's no trees. Herbie Nyakpuk says, I'm sure we'll be glad out of that country where it was all trees. The dogs didn't like it.
Right. Because George was from Huslia.
Yeah.
And Herbie's from Shishmaref.
Yeah.
So that trail that you got in on the up the hill, was that like a dead end? That was just there?
No.
Oh, it...
They just went up there to get a view and see where they were, see where the lights were of Caltag. Yeah.
So that connected you. That
and
was
so
the right
they just, So they just came back down and went into town. And when they left, they just stayed on the same trail. Yeah.
That's funny.
Yeah.
I was going to ask that you guys put the trail in from Knik to Skwentna and then, you know, out to Rhone, and Delia did it out to Rhone, but there's still, you know, 500 miles of trail.
Yep. And
how did you, who did
now,
that part?
Now, when, for instance, at Shaktulik, they got the trail to mark going back towards Unicleet, and then they got the trail going across the ice going to Koyuk.
Mm-hmm.
In the wintertime, they always stuck to the ice, right?
Yeah.
But there was a land trail. One year we almost took it to Ungalik and from Shaktulik, because of the way the ice was. Yeah, but the state of Alaska paid those guys so much a mile to mark the trail with spruce saplings.
Okay.
Yeah.
That was on the over the ice trail.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Because I was going to say, yeah, that you guys from this end, you know, we're marking the trail and blazing it, you know, up to maybe Ruby. And then, yeah, what happened? So the Yukon, you didn't have to mark. And then the Caltag won. And then...
See, Gullivan used to be a checkpoint 18 miles before you get to White Mountain. I can't remember the guy's name, Bob, but he and two other guys... put the trail in, marked the trail, and put the trail in from Gullivan to White Mountain to Nome. The second year of the race, when Tim White, the first out-of-state musher from Minnesota, got 7 miles from Nome, that same guy that put the trail in ran into the back of him at night.
Uh-oh.
It was a snow machine, yeah, and put him in the hospital.
Wow.
And I drove him back to Minnesota.
I was thinking, who would have been the guy in Gullivan?
I can't think of his last name. No.
Trying to think who I know from Gullivan. But anyway, so the historic trail designation... the official designation of it as a historic trail was in 1978.
Yes.
And so that covers all of this route that
we've just been talking about. By 1978, the trail is the same as the northern route today.
Okay.
Yeah.
And it covers all
That doesn't mean we utilize it all. I mean, comes all the way from Seward.
Right.
We never did use that.
Right.
And then it went from Kinnick, and we don't use that.
Right.
See? Yeah.
Right. But the historic trail designation goes all the way to Nome. It includes all that part on the sea ice and on the Yukon. And...
you know, no, I don't know that.
Okay.
I know that it goes to Ophir. Now, does it go to Iditarod?
I don't know.
See, I don't know either.
Or Flat? Or Ophir? Somewhere. It must...
Well, Flat's... no, Flat's a different deal from going to Iditarod.
It must go to, at least to Iditarod, because, as you say, it was the Iditarod Trail. So it goes from Seward to Iditarod.
Well, that's what I say. I thought that was surveyed all the way to Iditarod, because after that, in the Nome part, I mean, it's an established trail now,
right.
but I don't know what the official designation is.
Right. It may have been, you know, as you say, there were all these little feeder trails, and it's now become one.
Yeah.
Trail, and because historically people traveled by dog team between villages and trap lines, and then the airplane came along.
Well, you got the Parks Highway. There used to be the Parks Highway.
Right. And then the airplane, you know.
Yeah, yeah.
Walking or dog team was the only way to go.
Yeah. I drove from Fairbanks to Nenana when you couldn't go across the river except on the river bridge.
Right.
Well, I don't know what they called it, the Nenana Highway, I guess.
Probably.
Yeah. Now it's the Parks Highway, right. so I don't know that part of it.
Right. No. But as I say, Dorothy Page was into the history with that original race. But Joe wanted to bring dog mushing back, right? Is that how...
That's correct. There was a team came into the Fur Rendezvous, and I don't need to, never mind his name, I know who he is. And he came from Kiana. came into the Fur Rendezvous, and he traded his dog team for a snow machine. And this was happening all over. Mm-hmm. Now, if we wanted a good dog, where did we go to get them?
Villages.
We got them from a village. And why did we get them from a village? Because it was breeding that had gone on for hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of years.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. I'd like to think that we had a higher purpose than worrying about getting our dogs from the village, because every village had a dog team. Three dogs, five dogs, whatever. They didn't have teams like we had, okay? Or a lot of us had, because they had to haul the wood, they had to haul the water. They also had to fish for them.
Right.
A snow machine, you turn the key. Didn't have to fish. Yeah. Buy white man's gas. Give me a break. That's what it was.
Mm-hmm.
And so our intent, and I'll say Joe's intent, but those of us that felt the same way,
mm-hmm.
our intent was to put on a dog race that went through as many villages as possible to say, go ahead, we know snow machines are going to take over, but don't get rid of your dogs. You know, that snow machine will leave you out there to freeze to death,
right.
Which happened. Okay? Dog team will get you home. And we can have both. And today we have both.
Mm-hmm.
And that was the whole intent. And I think it was very successful.
Mm-hmm.
In 1973, there was not a dog team in Nome.
Oh, really?
Howard Farley had dogs that he showed tourists that Wien Airlines brought up there.
Right.
Okay? And Howard and Julie were dear friends of mine. He and I fished together.
Oh, okay, great.
Lived at his home. And of course, now they're both gone recently.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know why I'm still here, but I am. But... What,
so there were no dog teams in Nome, so the...
Now you can put on a race up there. There's that many dog
really?
Teams. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. So it's been very successful, I think.
Right.
Yeah.
Now, do you think that getting the trail designated as a historic trail, did that make a difference?
No. If it comes right down to it,
mm-hmm.
if you're going to have a dog team, you're going to have a dog team. Just because... there's a designated trail, but the point is, it's a green belt across Alaska.
Right.
That's what's important. You know, I'm one of those guys. I'm sorry, but I don't much care what happens in the lower 48. I'm completely 100% interested in what happens in Alaska.
Yeah. Right.
And I get very upset with some of the thoughts today.
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah.
But. So you're saying that the dog racing would have happened whether the trail was historically designated?
The dog race has been going on long before that.
That's true. The trail didn't get designated until 78.
No. I grew up 20 miles from dog racing.
Right.
You know, they called it a world championship. We call it a world championship. You know, whatever. I think... I'm concerned about dog racing today because of the, I think it's an old style doing stuff.
Uh-huh.
And young people today don't like old style doing stuff. You know?
Well, I like what you said, that the trail is a green belt across Alaska.
I think that's the main thing.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I think it's something that we as Alaskans should be proud of.
Mm-hmm.
There's a certain spot that's never going to lose that designation. They're not going to build on it. They're not going to develop it. And I think that's important. I happen to be one of those type of people. Build it. If we need it, if we can use it, build it. But I also... think it should be done properly, and having a green belt across Alaska, I think is a big deal. Yeah.
Okay. Yeah, because I know it was a big deal for Joe Reddington. He did a lot of lobbying to Senators Gravel and Stevens to get that
Ralph
designation.
Yeah, Gravel, you bet. They worked hard.
Yeah. Did you help with any of that?
Yes, I did. And I was one of those that, along with a few others, that just kind of donated their life to it.
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah. Some of it I regret. Yeah.
In what way?
Well, I was 24 hours a day I did or I wasn't very good for family atmosphere or kids' atmosphere. Yeah. And I know that.
Right.
Now.
Right.
I did at the time.
No.
Yeah. I did at the time. And financially it about broke me.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You said a lot of it was out of your own pocket.
It was all out of your own pocket. Yeah.
Well, did you and Joe get paid for that DNR contract?
We got paid for that, yes.
Do you know how much you got paid?
$25,000.
Between the two of you?
Between the two of us, yeah. Yeah.
And then that had to pay for your airplane gas, too,
oh,
right?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Yeah. Oh, yeah. But that, yeah. We never made money, that's for sure. No.
It's definitely. No. Well, and that's where you say, I know Joe lobbied a lot. So did you go to Washington, D.C.?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. That was a big deal for me. I was not one of the three teams, and I went with the Flying Tigers, the cargo 747 that flew the teams down there. Okay.
Oh, you guys took teams down to D.C.
We took three teams down representing the state of Alaska, for Ronald Reagan's inauguration parade.
Oh, that's right.
Yeah. And I happened to go with the dogs. And the captain of the 747 was in his last year of retirement and flew with Claire Chennault's Flying Tigers in Burma prior to the Second World War.
Wow.
Yeah. And at that time, I had a 180. And, of course, we were talking about it. When the co-pilot went upstairs, he says, I'm going up deck and make lunch. Do you mind if Dick sits in my seat? And so I got out of the jump seat, sat in the right seat. And he said, this is no different than your 180, just a lot bigger and heavier. Get a feel for it. And
wow.
Took it off of autopilot.
Wow, cool.
And I thought that was the greatest thing that ever was. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. But so besides that, taking the dogs for the inauguration, did you go to D.C. and lobby Gravel?
No. It was all done here in Alaska.
Oh, it was, okay.
Yeah. All of it, yeah. Reddington, none of us ever went to D.C.
Oh, okay.
No,
yeah,
no.
I just assumed
no.
He must have gone there to...
No. No, it was all done here. Yeah.
And what kind of things did you guys do?
Well, it was just a matter of meetings.
Mm-hmm.
Let's see, Don Young... Mm-hmm. Okay, he was a big promoter. That's where I first met him. He was a school teacher in Fort Yukon and used to bring the kids to the junior races in Fairbanks.
Okay.
And I brought my older kids up to Fairbanks to the junior races, and that's where Don and I first met. And we became friends, yeah.
All right, so do you remember any of the... arguments or any of the issues you guys tried to sell to these guys to promote it?
You know, there never was an argument about getting it. I guess the wheels in Washington turn slow.
Yeah, I guess, yeah. How did you persuade them that this was needed to happen?
Well, because there were other trails that came under that same designation.
Mm-hmm. In the lower 48,
yeah. Yeah, and I think there were two other trails. I think the Iditarod Trail was one of three, and so it was just kind of like a rider or whatever that went along with it. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I don't know all the details.
You know. Well, I was to say, you had to help persuade Senators Gravel, Stevens, and Representative Young to support this legislation.
It wasn't difficult.
Okay.
It wasn't difficult. And when we pulled off the race to Nome, it really wasn't difficult.
Right.
Yeah. I mean, it was a big deal.
It was
a big deal. The old mayor of Nome, Renshaw was his name, Mayor Renshaw, and he was the perfect Nome mayor with a handlebar mustache and his black hair, and he would meet every musher day and night. Mm-hmm. The siren would blow, and if you came in at night, he was wearing his nightshirt, and he would declare you a hero. And of course, we all knew we were.
Right. You were.
It didn't make any difference what position you came in. I mean, you drove a dog team all the way from Anchorage to Nome. We were a hero.
You were heroes.
And after 20, 21 days on the trail, you damn sure knew you were a hero.
Yeah. So what was Dorothy Page like as a person?
Dorothy Page was extremely opinionated. Yep.
In a good way or not?
You better stay in her good graces. Yeah. But she was really into it. She really was. And there again, it all came out of her pocket, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, that's just the way it was.
Yeah. The passion for it.
There were some $10,000 donations that first year. Muktuk Marston, what was his name that owned the hotel? Oh, God, I can't think of that. He donated $10,000. We never paid him back. He did his own deal and raised it himself.
Hickel.
No.
Not Sheffield.
He owned the Mushin Motel.
Yeah, that's what I was thinking was Hickel.
Which at one time was a pretty nice motel.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I don't know. It wasn't Sheffield, because he owned motels later.
No. Bill Sheffield was running for governor when I was president of Iditarod, and that paid off in the future.
That first Iditarod Trailblazers group that you guys formed, what did you guys do as an organization?
Nothing except talk about having a long distance race.
Okay. So you guys didn't go out and mark the trail?
No.
But you helped organize the first race?
Yeah. Dan Seavey ran the first race. And I don't know if he still is or not, but I know for years he was part of the Iditarod official Iditarod committee. I was at one time, and then, no.
He's part of the Trail Alliance group.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
And he really worked hard on the Seward end of it.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. And he's been interviewed.
Oh, yeah.
So we've got the Seward end of the story. And that's what I've heard. There's a Seward Trailblazers. I've heard about the Nome Trailblazers. Oh. I've heard maybe there was a Kinnick Trailblazers.
I'll show you.
So these are your membership cards,
yeah,
right?
Yeah.
Lifetime membership, Iditarod Trailblazers with your name and Joe Reddington's signature.
Yeah.
Dog Drivers of Alaska.
That's Fairbanks.
Okay. And Iditarod Trail Sled Dog Race, life member.
Yeah.
And your number, 50-0062. Does that mean you were the 62nd member? I don't know.
No, I don't know.
Right. But so, is there was there a Kinnick Trailblazers after your Iditarod Trailblazers?
After what now?
Was there a Kinnick Trailblazers? Or was
just
that?
No, if it was, it didn't have anything to do with the Iditarod.
Okay.
Yeah. There is a Kinnick. Yeah, just like there's an Aurora and a Willow and an Anchorage and
So they do all kinds of trails. They don't do just the Iditarod.
Right, yeah.
So a Trailblazers organization, what do they do?
Spend money.
No.
No. Actually, we all we did was just talk about promoting this. There was an Iditarod committee.
Right.
Okay. Which was a whole different deal. Yeah. So had nothing to do with these.
The Trailblazers didn't go out and brush out the trail and mark it or maintain it.
I don't remember doing that as a Trailblazer,
okay.
No.
Okay. Yeah, no. I was wondering if that part of their responsibility is to maintain the trail.
No. Okay. I just know what my... And I had a lot of help working on the trail. And I'd fly guys out and drop them off and go pick them up again. And, oh, my God, I got into some hairy stuff. Yeah.
Like what?
I remember one time I brought some guys in that had been working out on the trail, and I got in a snowstorm, and oh, man, I finally landed at Wasilla, and I went into the... That's when we had just got a office upstairs over the old Thielen store, and Kathy worked at the office up there. And I came in there and I said, boy, I'm sure lucky. We just made it. And it was tight. And I says, I'm going over to Kashim and have a beer. Well, Jules Mead, he piped up. He says, well, I'll go with you. And Kathy says, I'll go with you. And somebody else said, I'll go with you. And, well, we had breakfast the next morning. Yeah. But there was a few days like that. Ramey Reddington, he likes to tell about the time that Joe and I were out doing that trail deal for the state. And he says, yeah, I remember one time, he says, when all you did was clip off the tops of little spruce trees with your wings. It was some hairy flying.
Wow.
I went into Roan one time and barely made it out of there. Oh, boy. Yeah. Just kept hitting the tops of the trees.
Wow.
Yeah.
So how did you and Joe communicate on that, if you were in the plane and he was on the ground?
He had a CB radio.
A radio, ground-to-air radio?
Yeah,
okay. Yeah, I assumed that. But
And I might be in the air 30 minutes, and then we were on the ground for hours.
Oh, okay.
You know? And it was so funny. I could say, Joe, you're standing in the trail right now. Can you see an old blaze mark? You know? And of course, I'd circle around and I'd come right over him, and I ain't 50 feet off the trees, and I'd follow the trail and come up again, then I'd land.
Okay.
You know?
And then you'd go out and help blaze and, okay.
Yeah. It was fun.
Yeah, it sounds like it.
Not only fun, but it was so interesting to be a part of it. Yeah.
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 How many miles a day typically?
Well, it took us 6 weeks.
For how many miles total?
100 miles.
Okay.
Yeah.
About, okay.
Yeah. And of course, some of it was very obvious. You know? Yeah. Some of it was very obvious. We'd been running it for years.
Right, you'd already been using this end of it,
yeah.
And as you, I'm surprised
the tough part was from Susitna State. Well, no, that's not exactly true. Yeah, it was from Susitna Station to Squintna Crossing. That was a tough part.
Why?
Well, because it that was the old trail back in, you know, whenever.
Mm-hmm. And it just hadn't been used as much recently.
It hadn't been used at all.
Well, yeah, I mean, since the old.
There was no need to use it since.
Right.
I mean, when did the Iditarod Trail, as we know it, stop getting used? I don't know. I mean.
Yeah, I can't remember the exact dates, but when airplanes started.
Yeah.
Kind of the 1920s.
Yeah. But that map. Leslie Mead lives on Donovan Street at just a little ways past Clap Road on KGB. I don't know if you could take a picture of that map or something.
Yeah.
Boy, that's a valuable map.
Were there other maps that Joe had, like from the archives or anything? Or that was the only map you had?
That map was dug out of some of the ruins of Iditarod.
Okay.
Yeah.
But that's the only map you and Joe had?
Well, yeah, we never did have it.
Does
Jim Hastings gave it to me to raise money for Iditarod.
Oh, I see.
And Jules Meade purchased it.
Yeah. Oh, okay. I thought... So you and Joe didn't have any map you were following?
No.
Okay.
No. We just followed... You can see the trail so easily from the air.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, and I find it interesting that even though it was a winter trail, there were still ruts from the sleds that you could see in places.
Oh, yeah.
You'd think the snow would protect the...
It was... It's like I park my motorhome out here.
Uh-huh.
I've got horrible ruts. Yeah.
Yeah.
And
but a winter trail, you'd think the snow would... that the snow would protect the ground and it wouldn't have rutted. That's interesting.
You can tell where the trail is.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And
here's the thing. Here's another thing. Even though it was a winter trail, that doesn't mean it was snow time yet. It was a frozen.
Oh.
It's when the ground was frozen.
Okay.
More people walked the Iditarod Trail than rode with a dog sled or by dog team.
Mm-hmm.
And as it got going between communities, and then the mail drivers, they had the right of way.
Right.
And then the freight teams, and then the individual dog teams.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, but the mail team, then the freighters, and then the individuals.
Right.
Yeah, but I saw an old handwritten, not a handwritten, but a single sheet of paper that Walt Thielen showed me that at Kinnick, when it was a port, there was a, whatever you call them, advertising for a dog, $300. $300?
For one dog.
For one dog.
And what, like 1910 or something?
Well, I suppose.
Yeah.
When was Iditarod in its heyday?
Yeah, somewhere around then.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. I can't remember the...
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Wow. But $300, imagine.
That's got to be a good dog.
I mean, but they just wanted a dog.
Right.
Yeah. That could pack, what, 20 pounds? 25?
Probably more than that. A freight dog? I don't know. Those were heavy sleds.
Yeah. But I mean, when you put a pack on a dog, how much can it carry?
Oh, I see. Not a sled dog, but a pack carrying. Yeah, yeah, you're right.
Yeah.
Probably 25 pounds. Yeah. Those were big dogs.
Yeah.
The other thing I'm wondering about, you know, you mentioned the homesteads and where the trail went. And when you guys were putting in that trail, did you have to deal with issues about permits and easements and things? Like, I know in Coldfoot you had a problem with that.
Yeah. No, we did not.
Okay.
Okay. Now, when they came to survey it, maybe they did. Because, see, that's what I'm talking about, that the two ladies there at Nine Mile.
Right.
There's the trail. Whether you like it or not, ladies, I'm sorry, there's the trail.
Right.
Now, what the state had to do, or the federal government with the national trail, I have no idea.
Okay, so you guys, you didn't have to deal with that when you were marking
it. I didn't have, there's the trail, like it or not.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. Because I know in Coldfoot, the Coldfoot Classic, where you tried to get a permit for the Park Service, that was very complicated, to say the least, right?
Yeah, yeah.
Right.
It didn't need to be, but it did.
Right.
That's a whole other story.
It's a whole other story, but yeah. I didn't know if there was a parallel to...
And there's a lot of it that I wouldn't say
Right. Either. Well, I just didn't know if you faced similar things with the Iditarod.
No, we didn't have to worry about that.
Okay.
Joe and Dick find the original trail and mark it so that the outfit behind you can survey it.
Okay.
Is it?
Okay. Okay. I did have a question. I mean, we've talked about Joe, but we also know that his wife, Vi Reddington, she was involved as well, wasn't she?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. I have to imagine if you were married to Joe, you were involved no matter what. Joe was, 15 years older than I was? He and I thought alike. We spent countless miles together. Mm-hmm. And then when he got sick, Kathy and I were living in Nenana, and then one day, because I bought his dog team in Nome. I got out of dogs when I went to Coldfoot.
Right.
And shortly after, he said, "Hey, you need to have dogs." He said, and I said, "You know where there's a team for sale?" He said, "Yeah." He says, "I'll sell you my team." Told me the team that he crossed the finish line in Nome.
Wow.
Yeah. Yeah, it was a big deal back in those days. Yeah.
So yeah. What was Vi like as a person?
Vi was always, outwardly anyway, happy-go-lucky.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Backed Joe 100%. Backed him 100%. Yeah. And God, they had some tough times too, you know. He had a boy that passed away, and same age as my Bill.
So were there specific things that Vi did to help with the promoting the trail? And
no, she was just always the woman behind Joe that helped him.
Yeah.
I don't know what went on mm-hmm. with him, you know. Yeah.
But she was always there.
But she was always there.
She must have been pretty tough.
The lifestyle they led.
Yeah.
They had to be tough.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
You pioneers were all tough.
Yeah. She was a physically tough lady. Yeah.
Yeah.
Just like my wife.
Yep.
Yep. Tough lady. Yeah.
Yeah.
Put up with my crap, Shandy. Yeah.
Is there anything else about the trail itself and the work you did to put it in and any of those experiences that I haven't brought up yet?
All I can say is I'm proud I was part of it. It's something, there's two things. Is the Iditarod, my involvement in it, winning it was great.
Yeah.
But that's what you were striving for. So it's the event itself. It just had its 51st year.
Mm-hmm.
And then Kathy and I went to Coldfoot, and we built a facility up there in the middle of nowhere. And it's still there, and it will be.
Yep.
Okay. And when I was 26 years old when I came to Alaska, 65 years ago,
mm-hmm.
and I begrudged the time it took to eat and sleep. You know, there's a few people like that come to Alaska today, and we need more of them. We need more of them. I get so upset with people that we shouldn't do this, we shouldn't do that. The last road we built in Alaska was completed in 1971. Why are not the villagers, you know? Well, the airline companies don't like it. The seagoing freighters don't like it, you know? And a lot of the villagers don't like it, but a lot of the villagers do like it too.
Right.
But it doesn't get done because Washington knows how we should live. I don't know.
It's complicated.
It's complicated. You know, you used to build a school, and you just cleared 10 acres of land to build a school. Now they're smart. They build a school, and they leave it every tree they possibly can. Well, why can't you do that with a road? Mm-hmm. Or why can't you do that with something else? The only reason we became a state was because of our natural resources. We convinced Washington, D.C. that we could survive as a state because of natural resources. We had timber, we had fish, and now we got oil. Mm-hmm. And we have a hard time utilizing it.
Right. Well, you said you were proud of the part you played in getting the Iditarod Trail and the race reestablished.
Yeah.
It must have been hard, though.
It was terribly hard. In all honesty, it cost me a family. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And it did other people, too.
Right. Yeah. So if you had to go back, would you do it all
again?
I
wouldn't change a thing. Mm-hmm. I've done a few good things in my life, and I've probably done a lot of not so good things in my life, but that's all part of it. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah, well, it's interesting that the fact that the trail got this historic designation doesn't really matter to the race.
No.
Or...
No. No.
Yeah.
No.
It didn't benefit.
It's the event.
Yeah.
Yeah. And
so you guys would have done... Well, you started the race before the designation, but it kind of went hand in hand.
Well, it wouldn't have been designated as part of the national trail system today if we hadn't had the race.
Okay.
I'm convinced of that.
Right.
It's because we actually did it that put it in the limelight.
Okay.
Yeah.
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 So it worked the other direction.
I mean... Do you see any other part of it? Do you see the Denali Highway as part of the national deal, you know? Yeah. It's because we did it. Yeah.
Yeah. What was the village response and support for the villages that the trail was going through and past? Were they involved at all?
Oh, yeah. Oh, I think they used to draw names to see who could stay at their home.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. And after a few years, when it got a little larger number of people doing it, perhaps it wasn't fair, you know. But this business of corralling that they've had for years now, I hate that. It took the relationship from the musher out of the village.
What's corralling? What do you mean?
Well, you no longer can stay overnight in a person's home or something.
Yeah. Right. That's considered help now. Yeah.
Yeah. It was only fair to do that, to come to that, but it's too bad it did.
Yeah.
But I think there's going to be some... I think there's going to be some major changes in the idea. The first thing that, in my opinion, they should do is take all that electronic stuff and throw it away.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think there's something definitely wrong in any competitive event when I can get on the phone and call here and say, you're watching it on TV, what do you think I ought to do?
Yeah.
Something's wrong there.
Right.
Yeah. I think when you leave Willow, you're on your own.
Yeah.
Well, in 51 years, we've had a broken arm. We've had some hypothermia that other mushers took care of. You know, nobody's died out there.
Right.
And maybe someday somebody will. People die in all kinds of competitive events.
Yeah.
There have been instances... Where, help,
push the
come
button.
Help me.
Yeah.
Well, hey, put your big girl panties on or whatever.
Right.
Yeah. I just don't believe in that. There's the last place finisher today.
Right.
Okay. Is a week ahead of the winner.
Right.
What it used to be.
Right.
And we went through this business. Oh, well, you know, we can't have these tail enders. And so, I don't know, we were 10 years into the race, and I figured it up. First and last place was weak. First and last place today is the week.
There you go.
See, nothing's changed.
Yeah. Yeah, well, I was wondering, you know, the villages, you said they used to travel a lot between the villages. So did they already use parts of the Iditarod Trail and were...
Especially on the Yukon River.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But not the other parts? That...
No, very little of it.
Okay.
Until you got to... Unicleet would go to Shaktulik, but it...
Right.
Most of their communications back in those days was religious conferences.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. They'd have a church conference in Elam, and mm-hmm. people from White Mountain and Gullivan would go there, and people from, but, yeah.
Yeah, but so there weren't old-timers, old native elders like in Ruby who would know the trail back to Ophir, or that you could ask about the trail.
The first year we went to Iditarod, 1977, Adolph Hamilton from... Shagluck, when I was a boy, went with his dad to Iditarod.
Okay.
And he said, I think I remember how to go. And he put the trail in from Shagluck back to Iditarod in 1977.
Wow.
Okay. Had a terrible time doing it. Yeah. The first year of the race, I was running with Herbie Nyakpuk, Isaac Okliesik, and John Comack. John Comack was from Brevig Mission, which is just up the coast from Isaac's at Teller.
Mm-hmm.
And we get to the top of Topcock after leaving White Mountain. And I said, gee, John, how much further is it to
White Mountain?
No, we just left White Mountain.
Oh, to Nome? To safety?
To...
I mean, that safety would be...
Not Councilwood. Oh, I'd have to look at a book. My memory's
loose.
To the next... Sullivan.
Okay.
And the O'Kitkin boys, in 1951, 50 or 51, DIA closed the school.
At
Sullivan.
Okay.
And that was the demise of the town. Had some beautiful buildings there, really nice. And the O'Kitkin brothers lived in one, and to use the city, what was known as the City Hall, was just a wonderful old building. I had to get their permission, okay? So I'd fly in there and get that permission, okay? But then I get to the top of Topcock and I said to John Comack, where on earth is Sullivan? And you look out there and you see nothing. And he says, you see those two black specks over there? No. I said I did. He said, that's Sullivan. I said, how do you know that? You know what his answer was? Listen to this. When I was a young boy, I came with my father here one time.
And you remember?
Well, number one, why did they come from Brevig Mission there in the first place? But he did.
Yeah.
I mean, that's like, I think I'll drive to New York City. I mean,
well, that's what they did in those days. They traveled huge distances.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, that's what I was wondering, if some of those... Yeah.
But when I was a young boy...
Yeah, that they remembered.
Yeah. And then, you know, the first 2 years of Iditarod, we were timed. Okay? Donna Hanks and Jackie Knoll were the same timers that Dick Tozier had for the Fur Rendezvous in the North America. And we were timed. And this John Comack, who I had been running with ever since Ophir, he and Isaac and Herbie Nyerpuk. And I could come in behind him 20 minutes and beat him.
How?
Because of the time starting differential. Oh. See? We were actually timed. There was no making up time on a 24.
Okay, right.
But there's no way he was going to be able to comprehend that, you know? So I had to beat him. I mean, we only had 40 miles to go, and I had to gain more than 20 minutes on him. It was not easy.
You had some tough finishes.
Oh, man.
Sure.
But I was younger.
Yeah.
I was.
Well, it's interesting to hear about what you said about Adolf Hamilton and these other elders who could help tell where the trail went.
Yeah.
Was there anybody, other ones you remember, like in McGrath or Ruby or any place? Because as you say, once they're out on the river, it was pretty...
No, see, from McGrath, they have McGrath Landing on the Tocotin River, and there's a roadway. And then, actually, there's a road all the way to Ophir.
Oh.
What they call a rural road deal or something.
Was it an old mining road?
Well, yeah, but it's a current. There's current funds that maintain these old mining roads.
Right.
Yeah.
But in the 73, when the trail was first used, was that road there?
Well, yeah.
Okay.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. And but in the wintertime, it becomes a trail.
Right.
And some of the deals was utilized because it happened to be there. But it's just like Donlin Gold.
Uh-huh.
Okay? They want to build a natural gas pipeline from Anchorage all the way over there to the Kuskokwim. Mm-hmm. Where do you suppose they want to go?
They want to follow the Iditarod Trail.
Well, of course.
Because it's already there.
Well, and why is the Iditarod Trail where it is? Because those old-timers went where you could go.
Right.
You know, they knew how to go. The surprising part of it is, when we became a state, the new state Department of Transportation intended to put roads on all those places. We didn't have the money. Mm-hmm. But... of course it was going to go through Rainy Pass.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah, so the Iditarod Trail was never an RS-247 mining road. Yeah.
No.
Right.
Pieces of it were.
Okay.
Yeah. But that pipeline, if it ever comes to be, is not going to interfere with the Iditarod Trail.
Okay. Well, the trail's protected.
Huh?
As you said, the historic designation protects the trail.
Well, yeah. I mean, it might be 5 feet off of the designation. So what? I don't see it hurts anything. No, I think the one company, just my own personal feeling, the one company that has done everything correctly is Donlin Gold. I mean, for 20 years, they've gone to those villages and taken those kids and here's how you do this, and here's how you do that. And if it ever goes, and a young guy in his 20s can retire from there.
Yep.
And that part of the country needs that.
Uh-huh.
Needs that. And now, is it going to interfere with the environment? Maybe in some ways, but do it correctly. You know? You don't want the air polluted. You don't want the water polluted. You don't want the ground polluted any more than you have to.
Right.
Yeah.
But, well, I think you were lucky that you came in the early days and were able to be involved in things like this with the marking the trail and getting it designated.
Yeah. When I came to Alaska, I drove over the Denali Highway. It had just opened a year or two before. It was like driving up a rock creek bed, you know.
Right.
And I suppose there were some people that didn't like it back then. I think it's beautiful country.
It is.
And it didn't hurt it a bit by having the road there.
Right. No. Well, and the trail from, you know, Willow or Kinnick or wherever through the mountains and all that, that must be beautiful country.
Stunning. Yeah. And you know how big you are. You're speck. And you look at that mountain range. Oh, my God, I got to go across that thing. A couple of days later, oh, there it is. I went across it.
Yeah.
Wow. It's mind-boggling.
Yeah, it must have been exciting. Yeah.
And then you get out on the sea ice, for instance, going from Shaktula to Koyuk, and it's a clear day, which very seldom happens. And you say, holy mackerel, look what I'm doing.
Yeah.
I mean, it could be scary. Yeah. And I've seen it when it was.
Yes, it can be
very, very scary.
Yes. But yeah, I think being able to say you helped put that trail in, that section of trail, is pretty neat, pretty exciting.
Well, by working on a section down here, you still had no idea what it was like up there any more than they knew what it was like down here. It's a different world.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know, I happen to think that the people that live in that part of the world, boy, they really are tough people.
Yeah. Well, I say it's pretty exciting to say you helped pioneer that trail. Redesignate it, get it put back in.
Well, I don't know. I might think different. Today, most people that come to Alaska, they certainly have a job waiting for them, or they wouldn't come. They've managed to gather up some resources. Maybe they even got a nice home to move into. Mm-hmm. Or maybe the company even pays them to move here. I came up here with a wife and three kids and absolutely dead broke, didn't know a soul.
Yeah.
And Alaska appealed to my way of thinking. I think it's a great state. I still think it's a great state. I waited until I was a lot of years behind me before I got involved in the Iditarod, and especially before Coalfoot. And I think there's still opportunities today.
Mm-hmm.
But I think you have to just take the plunge, and a lot of people aren't willing to do that.
Yeah.
Well, what happens if I don't get a paycheck? You know.
Well, it is a different world, that's for sure.
It's a different world completely.
Okay, well, I think I'll wrap it up. I've made you talk for a long time.
Yeah.
Unless there's anything else, any other memories or stories.
Excuse me. There's a million of them if something brings it up.
Well, that's why I was trying to focus on, you know, the trail itself and the finding the route and marking it and that aspect of it.
Well, the funny part of it is, as you were doing it, you never thought about the future. It's when you look back on it, holy mackerel. Yeah.
Yeah.
That's when it amounts to something. Dan Seavey's a good friend of mine.
Mm-hmm.
And back a few years ago, about 10 years ago, before Shirley passed away, he says, maybe it's time for the Iditarod to end.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, I don't think it should ever end. I think it should change. I think you should want to run the Iditarod to run the Iditarod. You should want to run it to take a dog team from this part of the state to the other part of the state. Maybe all you get is a trophy. I don't care if you win, you're not going to make any money.
Right.
You know? And I think what money there is going to come from Alaska. People like Peter take care of that.
Right.
And you cannot change a radical's opinion. I was up at Nome, I don't know, a couple of years ago. Here's a woman with a sign. Okay. She says, "I know who you are." I said, "Well, I don't know if that's a compliment or not." And on the back of this sign is her speech that she's reading.
It was a animal rights kind of sign.
Yeah. They have no idea.
Right.
No. This year, they lost 3 dogs. Okay. It's unfortunate. And if you own them, it's damn unfortunate. But during the 2 weeks that those 3 dogs died, how many did they put to sleep at the shelter in Anchorage?
That's an interesting comparison, huh? Yeah. That's a good question.
If you go to the shelter in Anchorage, and years ago I used to, and I'd take my dogs there. And I had a dog that I just really felt a lot of, and they have a new machine down there that is the humane way to get rid of a dog. Mm-hmm. And it looked like a vacuum chamber.
Huh.
I put my dog in it, and the phone rang. And the lady went and talking on the phone and forgot to shut the machine off.
Oh, no.
I never went back.
Yeah.
It was pathetic.
Yeah.
It was, don't talk to me about a humane way.
Right. Well, hopefully that has not continued to be the practice.
No. I don't know.
It also seems very clear from talking to you that it's very hard to separate the history of the trail and the history of the race, that they're very interconnected. That what Dorothy and Joe and you started 1967 was the trail and dog racing all intertwined.
Yeah. I grew up milking cows. Okay?
In New Hampshire.
It's the same thing.
Yep.
It's 365 days a year. There's good and there's bad people doing it.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And dog mushing is no different. If you get in a bind and can't adequately take care of your dogs, then call for help.
Right.
Don't let it fall apart. Call for help. There's a lot of help out there.
Right.
I think from what I read, dog mushing is alive and well and prospering and growing.
Mm-hmm.
You know, when I first got into it, pretty ragged bunch of people.
Yeah.
And back then, you could do everything. You your own vet.
Right.
And I got a dog that no matter what I've done, no matter how many shots I give him, whatever, he's going downhill. I take it to the vet, and he dies. What the hell am I paying the vet for? So we got a bad vet reputation, you know. He lived. Oh, I didn't get any money anyway.
Well, and as you said, that the Iditarod race was going to continue whether the trail got a historic designation or not. That didn't make any difference to the dog mushers and the racers.
No. The only thing that I appreciate is the fact it's a green belt across Alaska. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah, and I just think that's important.
Well, and do you have any feeling about it as history, that it's preserving some sense of history?
It is, and I wished, well, there's, you know, when old buildings fall down, old buildings fall down.
Right.
I wish that people today could see some of the places I saw 50 years ago. And, of course, that's not going to happen.
Right.
You know, to me, it's, I just kind of shake my head. 50 years ago? Holy mackerel. You know?
Well, sometimes old buildings can be restored and preserved.
Yeah. I guess the one that really comes to mind is the one out there by Poorman.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I stopped, got out my snowshoes, and snowshoed over there to really look at it, you know.
Yeah.
And there are people that would look at it from the trail and say, oh, what a dump that is falling down. And then there's people who would see the history of it.
Right. Yeah. Yeah, and you see that the mushers today don't have that sense of history, maybe.
Very few. They're recent.
Yeah.
There's no camaraderie anymore. There's no sitting around a campfire anymore.
Right.
You know, that kind of stuff.
Yeah, well, it'd be interesting to think about if something could be done on the trail to help promote the history again for the mushers. They do other things, but...
You got to take the race out of it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, I was thinking, like Norman Vaughn did some recreating Serum Run stuff, but that wasn't for the Iditarod Trail.
No, but that was another trail I put in from Nenana to, well, actually I put it in from Nenana all the way to Tanana.
Okay.
That was an experience.
Yeah.
I mean, the old trail, but we actually cut it so that you could get through.
Oh, because it had...
Yeah.
But that wasn't an old... the old Mintil Trail, the old Native Trail?
Mm-hmm. Yep.
So when did you put that in?
The year that Joe started that deal going to Nome.
Oh.
Mm-hmm. I can't remember the year. Yeah. That was my downfall. I was always involved in the trail. Yeah. And in the fall of 1977, Joe was over to the house and was sitting there drinking coffee, and although he drank Tang and I drank coffee. And I said, I hate to tell you this, buddy, but I'm gonna back off for a year on some of this work. And my dog team's getting old. I'm going to see what I can do. And lo and behold, I won by 1 second.
Right.
But, yeah.
Yeah.
And when I originally moved from Anchorage to Wasilla, I moved to the Snow Belt, which is now Willow.
Right.
It might not be this in any one winter, but... Overall, the Snow Belt is Willow now. That's how much things have changed.
Yeah.
But, yeah.
Well, it sounds like lots of good memories.
Yeah, really. Yeah. Yeah. And the people along the way.
Yeah.
Yeah. I remember that first year. We came to Big River, which was actually, it was one checkpoint. You left Farewell Station, and then there was what they call Big River, which had an old roadhouse, broken down, fallen down. And there was a guy in a tent with a ham radio operator. He had no idea where he was. And anyway, here's an old half broken down log building, which was the old, what did I just say?
Roadhouse.
Roadhouse. And there was a guy named Esau and his wife there from Nikolai. And they had just got there an hour or so in front of us, going down there to do his spring beaver trapping, and invited us in. And Ron Aldridge and I were the, there was Ron Aldridge, Ron Oviak from Point Hope, and Ramey Reddington, and I. And Ron Aldridge and I, we were the old guys. So when it came time to bed down, they suggested that we sleep in the bed built into the side of the wall. And they had built a fire, and it snowed like a son of a gun. Oh man, it just piled up. And this Esau guy said, in the morning, I'll snowshoe the trail, because if you miss the portage, you'll be going, following the river, and you'll go miles out of your way. Okay. So Ron and I, we throw our sleeping bags down on that bed. Well, pretty quick, it gets pretty warm. And I said, hey, Ron, this bed's coming alive. Yeah. So, oh, man, it's hot up here. We'd do better on the floor.
Because the fire was so hot? Is that
why? Yeah. The cabin was warming up, and the animals were coming alive. And, so anyway, the next morning, we're waiting and waiting and fooling around and thinking, when's this guy going to put in the trail? And he's thinking the same thing. When are you guys going to get going? And so, finally, he gets out there. It is the greatest display of snowshoeing I have ever seen. And some years later, when we were going through Nikolai, I happened to meet him and reminded him of that. He put on those snowshoes with a string on each foot.
Okay.
Because you couldn't put your foot on. That's how high the snow was.
Oh, I see.
And he never stopped. And we're behind him with the dogs. And he got to this portage and waved us on. And I turned around. He's going back some way. Yeah. Hey, man, that guy could run on snowshoes.
Wow. So yeah. Yeah. How long good. Did it take?
Huh?
How long was he out there snowshoeing?
Oh, it was several miles.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Wow.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, it was such a snowstorm that Tozer sent snow machines back finally and went over the trail. Yeah. Yeah. Anybody behind us, they'd have been in trouble without that. Yeah.
Yeah.
But back in those days, now you've got a trail no matter what.
Right.
Yeah. You didn't used to have. No. And you couldn't find it. Oh, my God.
So even though you guys went and marked it and blazed it, there were times you still
Well,
couldn't find
see, and that part, we only ran for 2 years.
Oh, okay.
See? Yeah.
And then you rerouted it.
Yeah, and then they started this business up at Willow.
Oh,
yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. Yeah.
All right. Well, I thank you so much for your time.
Well, it's been fun. I was always bugged, you know, why didn't you take some pictures? So I got two of these throwaway cameras with 36 in them. You remember when they had those?
Yep.
One of them froze. I didn't get anything.
Right.
And the other one, I had the tail end, 36 pictures of a dog team. Yeah. Yeah. That's all you do is concentrate.
Yeah. I mean, as you say, you were out doing it. You're not thinking about what it's going to mean in 50 years.
Well, no.
And you just did it.
I could have taken some pictures. Yeah. Yeah. But I can, well, I spent a lot of time, not just in the race, but other than that. I set up all the trick point system that we have today and everything. The committee gave me all the $300 to do that. Yeah. And I was still learning to fly back then. And I don't think I want to do that. So I got a guy in. He had Anchorage Towing and Wrecking. I can't, Jim somebody. And he picked me up at Wasilla Airstrip. And we started out for Nome. And we no sooner got up, we left Pontilla Lake and got up there and ran into a snowstorm. And he started going up and up and up. And oh, crap. So anyway, and then we made it over to, I think, Farewell in those days, and then went on to McGrath. And then we left McGrath. And now, this guy's wearing a suit and a tie. And I'm not impressed with him at all. And then he started kind of circling around. What the hell's this guy doing? He said, "Ha! There's Gaines Creek! There I was, 1939, when I signed up for the Army." Okay. He was a good guy.
He passed the test.
Yeah. There I was back 1939 when I signed up for the Army. And all of a sudden, I thought he knew what he was doing.
I also just was thinking about all that time you spent doing the trail work and running the trail, the connection you have. Like, you know, when you say Pontilla Lake, you know exactly what it looks like.
Yeah, yeah.
You have a deep connection to that land and the landscape. And those 6 weeks you spent with Joe on the trail.
Oh. See, you know,
it has a lot of meaning for you.
My dad passed away the first year of the first day.
Yeah. And yeah. You didn't know about it until you got to know.
That's right.
Right.
And Joe and I had always been, we always just hit it off. And sometimes we'd talk some pretty serious stuff. And he became my dad. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Even though there was only 15 years difference, he became my dad. And anyway, before he passed away, Vi called up. We were living in Indiana, and she said, "You need to get down here." So we did. We come right down. And Joey had moved from up there to Eureka and was taking care of him. Mm-hmm. Vi wasn't taking care of him. And we walked in the house, and Joe says, "Joey, get me dressed. I'm going to the dog lot." Mm-hmm. And Joey says, "No, you can't go, Dad." At that time, he was getting maybe 300 calories a day.
Yeah.
And he said, "I said, get me dressed. I'm going to the dog lot." He did.
Wow.
Kathy and I visited with Vi while we got him dressed. And we went out to the dog lot, and we sat on a bench there. And he and I talked dogs. And that's the last time he was in a dog lot.
Yeah. But that...
I got a picture of that out in the garage. Yeah.
Not so many people have that connection to the landscape and that you do from having spent so much time out on that trail.
And the people in the villages. Mm-hmm. I don't know. Right. Hell, they've all passed away.
Right.
Yeah. There was Ernie Edlin in Elam. He drew my number, and I can't remember who else, the first year of the race. And he decided he was going to make pancakes and give us eggs for breakfast, which he probably had never done in his life. But he was good. This was an honor.
Right.
Okay. God, we ate him.
Not the best. Huh?
No, they were awful. Yeah, and I mean, you almost said, Ernie, what do you normally have? That's what we'll have too.
Probably normally had muktuk or dry fish or something.
But it's stuff like that. I'd get to Unicleat, and. Mary Lou, I'll think of her name now. After a while, she'd say, her daughter would be there at the checkpoint, and she'd say, Dick, mom's got your steak cooking, you know? Well, then here's this guy that maybe is a rookie. He don't have no place to go.
Right.
So that wasn't right either, you know? That's what changed it all.
Right. Yeah. But those special moments, for sure.
Yeah.
In those days.
Yeah, I can say that in every place, you know. Over there at a Pullman with Norman, I wish I could remember his last name, and his wife's name was Bertha, and they lived in Anchorage. And, boy, they had some nice houses. Old.
Yeah.
Like flat houses. You ever been to flat?
No, I've never been out there.
Yeah. I tried to buy one time, and it was one of those... Yeah, you couldn't buy a native allotment type thing, you know. Yeah.
Well, that's why I say I've never been out in that country. And that's why to hear you talk about it, I can tell it means a lot to you.
Oh, yeah.
From all that time you've spent there.
Yeah. This Jim Hastings. I had an Indian from up at Kantishna call me one night when I was living over here north of Wasilla. He says, I got a dog for you. Oh, I drove right up there. I'm always interested in a dog. And nice big dog. Too big for what I was using, but I was raising some chickens. I had 100 little chicks about like that. I went to town and I came home and there was one left.
Oh, no.
And here's that dog sitting there with a tail on it. So I took it over to Jim. It was he and Kathy and two sons. And we'd been there 3 years, I guess, now. And every time I did a lot of work up in Nome, Kosovo, and every time I'd go, I'd stop in and bring a case of peaches or something,
right.
Fruit. And we got to be good friends. I stopped in there one time, and just she and Kathy and the two boys. I said, where's Jim? Well, he's building a new cabin over on the other valley, which is the one leading into Flat, coming from McGrath. I said, what are you going over there for? Well, he says, it's too crowded around here. Geez, we only came once a year. And just wanted some different deals. Well, that was on the way to Kotzebue. On the way back, a few days later, I stopped. There's Jim. I said, well, I'm glad you're here. I said, last time I was here, you was over working on a new cabin. I said, how far is it anyway? He says, well, I don't rightly know. But it's 2 hard days on snowshoes.
Wow.
Now, 2 hard days on snowshoes for him was 35 miles anyway.
Yeah.
And what are you doing here? I run out of tobacco. I ran out of tobacco. Well, in 1985, I was the race manager. And it was a terrible year because the Iditarod, as usual, had no money. And we sent all our food shipments out through this, I don't know, interior mail deal where it goes at a reduced rate.
Oh, bulk mail?
Yeah. And no planes could fly out of McGrath. That's where some of the food went. And then it went to Galena, and then it went to Holy Cross. And so they put a stop on the race. And actually, they didn't need to, because you always knew who was going to be close to the lead, if not in the lead, and their food, you'd make sure that food was there, and then a few more guys, and on and on and on. But anyway, a guy up from Anatovic was the radio operator, and we hadn't got to satellites yet. And he was at Iditarod, and I pulled in there, and everybody's got a long face. And the school kids each year from the Iditarod Area School District would be the people, you know, the kids, and Holy Cross kids. And Kathy was cooking soup for all those kids. There must have been 20 of them. And somehow that kettle tipped over onto her, boiling. And I came up there, you know, and of course I'm all, ha, 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 and everybody's sad. And Jim says, Kathy got hurt. What's the matter? Told me, and where is she? She's in bed. He said, Dick, I wouldn't let anybody else see my wife but you. I went in there, oh my God, that had spilled over the front of her, and huge blisters all over.
Oh, she was really burned.
Just blisters. I said, Jim, she's got to get to the doctor.
This was Kathy Hastings.
Okay, yeah.
Yeah, okay.
And I said, Jim, she's got to get to the doctor, to the hospital. Well, we don't have any money. I said, that doesn't make any difference. She's got to get... I said, I'll fly her into McGrath, and then we'll get a jet in there. And, well, then, the radio operator, he got on the radio, and what they did is, because it was the school kids from Holy Cross, they hired her as a school cook.
Oh.
So she had insurance.
Okay.
Yeah. And I don't know whomever, somebody else besides me, got her into McGrath and got her into Anchorage. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, I think I don't know if that's your dog Foxy barking or another dog barking.
Yeah. Kids are here. Grandkids are here.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, Lance's kids. Yeah.
Okay. Well, I think we should finish off then.
Okay.
And let you go be grandpa.
Yeah.
Okay. Thank you very much for your time.
You're more than welcome. Most of this was just talking.
Yeah.
Yeah.